How long till AGI? You might think that my discussion so far is idle speculation, because AGI is still thousands of years away. But this would be a mistake. It's certainly true that we don't know when we will build AGI. But uncertainty cuts both ways. Technological developments can be surprisingly slow, but they can also be surprisingly fast. For example, the British Indian geneticist, JBS Haldane, was one of the first people to grasp the sheer scale of the future and its moral import. In a 1927 essay called The Last Judgment, he expresses a vision for the human future over the next 40 million years. To my knowledge, it's the first time that anyone predicted that humanity could spread across the galaxy. Yet, in the same essay, Haldane predicted it would take over 8 million years for us to make a return trip to the moon. In some cases, even when there's a clear trend in technological progress, people can fail to pick up on it. For instance, the cost of solar panels has been consistently declining on an exponential trend for more than 40 years. But all mainstream economic models have failed to extrapolate this trend forward, and so have tended to be too pessimistic on solar deployment. Exponential progress, let alone super-exponential progress, is hard for us to grasp. AGI might still be far in the future, but it might come soon, within the next 50 or even 20 years. The most weighty evidence for this is marshalled by Ajaya Kochra. Her report forecasts trends in computing power over time, and compares those trends to computing power of the brains of biological creatures and the amount of learning they require to attain their abilities. Using what we know from current neuroscience, today's AI systems are about as powerful as insect brains, and even the very largest models are less than 1% as powerful as human brains. In the future, this will change. The cost of computation is exponentially falling, while both the efficiency of AI systems and the budgets of the largest machine learning training runs are exponentially increasing. Based on extrapolations of these trends and our best guesses from neuroscience, Kochra found that we are likely to train AI systems that use as much computation as a human brain within roughly the next decade, and that we may well have enough computing power to essentially simulate the complete history of biological evolution by the end of this century. These comparisons involve a lot of uncertainty, such as in how much computation the human brain uses. Taking this uncertainty into account, Kochra gives a greater than 10% chance of AGI by 2036 and a 50% chance of AGI by 2050. On a podcast discussing her work, Kochra says that, as a result of her research, she's now thinking of AI much more viscerally as this onrushing tide. She acknowledges it's a quite extreme and stressful and scary conclusion, because I'm forecasting a date by which the world has been transformed. But isn't this timeline inconsistent with machine learning experts' views on the matter? No. In 2016, Katya Grace, founder of the think tank AI Impacts, ran what's currently the most comprehensive survey. About 350 top machine learning researchers estimated by what year unaided machines can accomplish every task better and more cheaply than human workers, a notion very similar to AGI. The main conclusion from the survey was that machine learning experts as a whole don't have stable and consistent beliefs about the matter. The average response was that there is a 10% probability of unaided machines being able to accomplish every task better and more cheaply than human workers by 2025, and a 50% probability by 2061. But when asked about a different operationalization of AGI, when, for any occupation, machines could be built to carry out the task better and more cheaply than human workers, the average response was a 50% probability of AGI by 2138, more than twice as many years into the future as the previously quoted prediction of 2061. Those surveyed also predicted it would take much longer for AI systems to outperform humans at AI research than to outperform humans at every task, which is impossible. This means that we shouldn't place much weight on surveys of machine learning experts when trying to predict timelines to AGI. But it also means that we cannot at all say that the experts think that AGI is centuries away. Under some framings of the question, at least, they say that AGI might well come within the next few decades. A different response you might have is that we've been trying and failing to build AGI for decades, with overinflated hype along the way, so any future prediction should be treated with skepticism. But the previous hype is commonly exaggerated. There was widespread over-optimism in the 1950s and 60s, but there were also many dissenting voices. And, more important, people crying wolf in the past doesn't tell us much about what we should think now. Another researcher at Open Philanthropy, Tom Davidson, created an estimate of timelines to AGI based only on how long we've been doing AI research, how much more research effort we should expect in the future, and analogues to comparable historical events. His best guess was that if you only had access to this information, you should think that the probability of AGI by 2036 is around 8%. You should then adjust this estimate up or down based on additional information, like recent achievements in AI. All these sources of evidence are fallible. Long-run forecasting seems difficult enough to me that we should remain highly uncertain. But these threads, in combination with the astonishing progress that has been made in AI over the last decade, should make us take short timelines to AGI seriously. I don't think that one could reasonably go lower than a 10% chance of AGI in the next 50 years. But if so, there's a very significant chance that one of the most important developments in all of history will occur within our lifetime. Culture and lock-in. What if AGI is centuries away? It would still be of enormous importance, because it creates a date at which the predominant values of a time could get locked in. And what we do over the coming years could affect what values are predominant when AGI is first built. The examples of religions and other moral worldviews already show that values can persist for centuries, though they evolve along the way. But values could become even more persistent in the future if a single value system were to become globally dominant. If so, then the absence of conflict and competition would remove one reason for change in values over time. Conquest is the most dramatic pathway by which a single value system can become globally dominant, and it may well be the most likely. In the next chapter, I'll suggest that there's a significant chance of a third world war in our lifetime. If that happens, perhaps the outcome will be a single world government and the global promotion of that government's ideology. Indeed, cultural conquest is quite commonplace. When we look at the map of the distribution of world religions, much of it can be explained by the history of conquest and colonialism. Protestant Christianity is the most common religion in the United States because of British colonialism. Catholicism is the most common religion in Latin America because of Spanish and Portuguese colonialism. Afghanistan was primarily Buddhist for around 800 years, from the 2nd century BC to around AD 650. The start and end of this period were both driven by conquest. First, the conquest by the Buddhist Mauryan Empire, and sometime later the Kushan Empire. Second, the conquest by the Rashidun Caliphate, the first caliphate established after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. Today, almost 1,400 years after this conquest, 99.7% of the population of Afghanistan is Muslim. And there are historical examples of ideologies that have sought long-lasting global domination. This was true of the Nazis, who referred to their empire as the Thousand-Year Reich. Similarly, the vision of global communism was promoted by the Soviet-controlled organization Comintern, which, before World War II, held 7 world congresses designed to further the aim of world revolution. But even if no single value system conquers all others, we might still converge to a single hybrid value system that is a blend of multiple sets of values, like different colors of paint mixed together to produce a new hue. This might look like convergence to a single best moral worldview, but really it's just a function of what values the world started with and how heavily represented each were. The nature of the values that the world converges on would depend on how powerful different value systems were before that point. And this can be affected by many factors. Conquest that falls short of global domination is one. A second way for a culture to become more powerful is immigration. For example, for the last 130 years, the United States has been the world's largest economy. By definition, The size of a country's economy is given by its GDP per person and its population size. And the United States' current population size is due, in part, to the high rates of immigration from Europe to North America from 1607 onwards, and especially after 1830. In the future, countries that maintain high rates of immigration and cultural assimilation will grow in size and power. Indeed, journalist Matt Iglesias recently proposed that, in order to maintain global influence, the United States should radically increase immigration, aiming to have a population of 1 billion people. A third way in which a cultural trait can gain influence is if it gives one group greater ability to survive or thrive in a novel environment than some other group. You might think that this consideration is not terribly important, because people already inhabit almost all the remotely habitable areas of Earth. But when we look to the future, there is a vast territory that civilization might expand into – space. Even within our own solar system, the potential energy outside of Earth is over 1 billion times greater than that on Earth. Even within our own galaxy, there is billions of times the energy outside of our solar system than within. If one culture made greater efforts to settle in space, or had greater ability to do so, then eventually it would dwarf any culture that chose to remain earthbound. A final way in which one culture can outcompete another is via higher long-run population growth. For example, through a combination of high conversion rates and high fertility rates, Christianity rose to become the predominant religion in Europe over what was a remarkably short time period in historical terms. Christianity maintained a growth rate of 40% per decade over the course of centuries. In AD 40, there were only 1,000 Christians. By AD 350, there were 34 million Christians, constituting over 50% of the population of the Roman Empire. This exponential growth explains, in significant part, why Christianity became one of the major world religions. But to pagan Romans in AD 40, the idea that Christianity would become the dominant religion must have been laughable. Some modern religious groups have matched the growth rates of the early Christians. For example, in the 20th century, the Mormon population grew at 43% per decade because of high fertility rates, missionary activities, and high retention. This same force will continue to shape the future. I live in an extremely secular bubble, and my naive view was that the proportion of the world which is atheist would inexorably increase. But this is not what's projected to happen. On average, atheists have few children compared to the religious, especially fundamentalists and those in poorer countries. Over time, this matters. According to the Pew Research Center, by 2050, the proportion of people with no religious affiliation, which includes atheists, agnostics, and people who do not identify with any religion, but who may hold some religious or spiritual beliefs, will decrease from 16% to 13% of the world population. The primary reason for this is the higher fertility rate among religious groups. Conversions in and out of a religion play a surprisingly small role in total numbers. If these trends continue into the future, then secular influence will slowly ebb away. This could mean that most of the world ends up following a single religion. Similarly, many of the most powerful countries today are powerful, in part, because of historical high fertility rates. India is currently the third largest economy in the world, in part because its population grew from around 290 million people in 1900 to almost 1.4 billion people today. Even though India's fertility rate has dropped to 2.2 births per woman today, it could well become the world's largest economy by the end of the century. By then, its population size is predicted to be 40% greater than China's. For similar reasons, Nigeria looks set to become a far more important geopolitical actor by 2100, because its population is projected to grow from 200 million to 730 million, making it the third most populous country in the world. The mechanisms I've discussed so far concern competition between groups. But cultural competition also occurs between specific cultural traits, both within a culture and across cultures. The recent successes of the gay rights movement and, subsequently, the LGBTQ plus rights movements are examples of what once were minority attitudes to sexual orientation and gender identity successfully becoming much more prevalent over time. The rise of meditation and mindfulness in Western countries and the rise of fast food in Eastern countries are examples of specific cultural traits successfully transmitting from one culture to another. If the world converged on a single value system, there would be much less pressure for those values to change over time. This global convergence could therefore lead to even greater persistence of values than we've seen historically. A single global value system could persist for thousands of years. And if it lasted until the development of AGI, then it could persist forever. How locked in are we already? I've discussed various ways in which a single value system could become globally dominant, and ways in which it could entrench itself for a very long time. I've presented this as a threat we've avoided to date and will face in the future. But lock-in is not an all-or-nothing thing. There are countless distinct moral norms, each of which could be locked in or not. So we should ask about the degree to which history has already locked in certain values, or at least has made some values very unlikely to change in the future. It's plausible to me that quite a bit of lock-in has already occurred. This starts at least with the emergence of Homo sapiens, which was probably analogous to the cultural lock-in that I've sketched in this chapter. A single species was able to gain power more rapidly than others, and thereby entrench dominance on the planet. The members of the Homo genus that went extinct soon after Homo sapiens entered their terrain include the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, Homo luzonensis, Homo erectus, Homo heidelbergensis, and Homo floresiensis. Now that all the other Homo species are extinct, there's essentially no chance that they will be resurrected and take over the world. If evolution had gone down a different track, it's plausible that some other species, in some ways quite different from us, could have evolved cumulative cultural learning and higher intelligence. Perhaps they could have been more hierarchical, like chimpanzees, or more egalitarian, like bonobos. They could have been more aggressive, or less. They could have had more differences between the sexes, or fewer. Our biological nature leaves an awful lot open, but it still makes some sets of values more likely to thrive than others. A second major point of lock-in, it seems to me, occurred with colonialism. Homo sapiens was geographically united when it evolved. Then, after spreading across the world, it was separated into distinct populations. After the colonial era, the world became globally interconnected once again. So it became possible for a single ideology to have global reach. And indeed, Western European powers killed off many alternative cultures, such as the Taino in the Americas, and forced their culture onto many others. It resulted in the enormous spread of Christianity, of the English and Spanish languages, and of Western European culture more broadly. Since that point, because of globalization, most countries have been becoming more culturally Western over time. If this process continues, there will eventually be even greater homogenization across cultures. One way of gauging the current diversity of cultures is to consider the range of responses countries made to the COVID-19 pandemic. There was, of course, some diversity, from the ultra-strict lockdowns in China to the more moderate response in Sweden. But the range of responses was far more limited than it could have been. For example, both the Moderna and the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines were designed by mid-January 2020 over the course of a few days. Not a single country allowed human challenge trials of the many vaccines developed in 2020, where willing volunteers would be vaccinated and then deliberately infected with the coronavirus in order to very quickly test the vaccine's efficacy. Not a single country allowed the vaccine to be bought on the free market prior to testing by those who understood the risks, even on the condition that they report whether they were subsequently infected. I'm not going to argue here that any particular policy was better than another, but the global benefits of a diversity of responses would have been immense. If just one country had allowed human challenge trials or had allowed vaccines to be sold freely, we all would have gained the knowledge that the vaccines were effective months earlier than we did. It would still have taken significant time to ramp up production of the vaccines, but we could have brought forward the end of the pandemic by several months. In this case, homogeneity in the global response to COVID-19 was responsible for millions of deaths. Building a morally exploratory world. The lock-in of some values, like Nazi or Stalinist values, would obviously have been horrific. Illustrations of some of these scenarios have been sketched in fiction. Most famous is George Orwell's 1984, in which this bleak prospect is epitomized in the famous metaphor of a boot stamping on a human face, forever. Even more impressive, in my view, is Swastika Night, written by Catherine Boderken. It takes seriously Hitler's claim that he would create a thousand-year Reich. Set 700 years in the future, it depicts a world which is entirely controlled by the Nazis and the Japanese Empire. In the German Empire, non-Germans have been subjugated, violence is glorified, and women are kept in pens and raped at will. To us, it reads like a piece of alternative history, but it was really a prophetic warning about ideological lock-in. The book was written in 1935, 4 years before World War II broke out, and published in 1937, 12 years before 1984, at a time when Hitler still had considerable international prestige. From what I've said so far, you might conclude that we should aim to lock in the values we today think are right, thereby preventing dystopia via the lock-in of worse values. But that would be a mistake. While the lock-in of Nazism and Stalinism would have been nightmarish, the lock-in of the values of any time or place would be terrible in many respects. Think, for example, of what the world would be like if Western values of just 2.5 centuries ago had been locked in. The future would be shaped by values in which slavery was permissible, there was a natural hierarchy among races, women were second-class citizens, and most varieties of sexual orientation and activity were abhorrent. Almost all generations in the past had some values that we now regard as abominable. It's easy to naively think that one has the best values. Romans would have congratulated themselves for being so civilized compared to their barbarian neighbors, and in the same evening, beaten people they had enslaved, or visited the Colosseum to watch the disembowelment of a prisoner. It is extraordinarily unlikely that, of all generations across time, we are the first ones to have gotten it completely correct. The values you or I endorse are probably far from the best ones. Moreover, there are so many ethical questions to which we know we haven't yet figured out the answer. Which beings have moral status? Just Homo sapiens? Or all primates? Or all conscious creatures, including artificial beings that we might create in the future? How should we weigh the promotion of happiness against the alleviation of suffering? How should we handle uncertainty about the impact of our actions, especially when it comes to tiny probabilities of enormous payoffs? How should we act when we know we don't know what the right thing to do is? And the list I've given only points to the areas of uncertainty that we know about. For thousands of years, the permissibility of slaveholding was almost unquestioned by those who dedicated their lives to ethical reflection. We should also worry about gross moral errors that we haven't yet even considered, that are invisible to us, like water to a fish. The track record of past moral errors suggests that we are guilty of such grave errors today. We see historical attempts by the Qin, the European colonialists, and the Nazis to lock in their ideologies as terrifying, and rightly so. But if we are guilty of gross moral errors ourselves, then locking in our present values would also be a disaster. Instead, we should try to ensure that we have made as much moral progress as possible before any point of lock-in. Political philosophers often argue over what an ideal state would look like. I think we should accept that we don't know what the ideal state would be. The primary question is how we can build a society such that over time our moral views improve, people act more often in accordance with them, and the world evolves to become a better, more just place. As an ideal, we could aim for what we can call the long reflection, a stable state of the world in which we are safe from calamity, and we can reflect on and debate the nature of the good life, working out what the most flourishing society would be. I call this the long reflection, not because of how long this period would last, but because of how long it would be worth spending on it. It's worth spending 5 minutes to decide where to spend 2 hours at dinner. It's worth spending months to choose a profession for the rest of one's life. But civilization might last millions, billions, or even trillions of years. It would therefore be worth spending many centuries to ensure that we've really figured things out before we take irreversible actions like locking in values or spreading across the stars. It seems unlikely to me that anything like the long reflection will occur. But we can see it as an ideal to try to approximate. What we want to do is build a morally exploratory world, one structured so that, over time, the norms and institutions that are morally better are more likely to win out, leading us, over time, to converge on the best possible society. This would involve several things. First, we would need to keep our options open as much as possible. This gives us a reason, though not necessarily a decisive reason, to delay events which risk value lock-in. Such potentially irreversible events might include the formation of a world government, the development of AGI, and the first serious efforts at space settlement. It also gives us a reason to prevent smaller-scale lock-ins, for example, by supporting conservation efforts. Even if we don't know whether some species or work of art or language is valuable, there is an asymmetry between preserving it and letting it be destroyed. If we preserve it and conclude later that it's not worth holding on to, then we can always change our minds. If we let it be destroyed, we can't ever get it back. Second, a morally exploratory world would favor political experimentalism, increasing cultural and intellectual diversity, if possible. We saw that we might already be on the way to a single global culture. If we are aiming to get to the best possible society, we should worry about premature convergence, like a teenager marrying the first person they date. In On Liberty, John Stuart Mill argues that we should allow individual liberty and free expression because doing so creates a marketplace of ideas where different ideas can compete and the best ideas win. We can apply the same ideas at the level of societies. The abolition of slavery came about in part as a result of cultural experimentation. In the 18th century, the United States was, comparatively speaking, a melting pot of cultural and religious diversity. This diversity enabled one community, the Quakers, to develop their own views on the morality of slavery. After they had come to see its immorality, that idea had the potential, under the right conditions, to spread. One particularly interesting idea for promoting cultural diversity of societies is that of charter cities. Autonomous communities with laws different from their surrounding countries that serve as laboratories for economic policies and governance systems. For example, in 1979, Deng Xiaoping created a special economic zone around the city of Shenzhen, giving it more liberal economic policies than the rest of China. Average yearly income grew by a factor of 200 over 40 years. Its success inspired broader economic reforms across China, which, over the course of the last 40 years, have lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Charter cities are often promoted by those who want to see more economically liberal policies. But there is no necessary connection between these two ideas. For almost every social structure we can imagine, we could have a charter city based on that idea. There could be Marxist charter cities, and environmentalist charter cities, and anarchist communitarian charter cities. We could find out, empirically, which of these brings about the best society. And, in addition to creating a diversity of formal institutions, we could try to cultivate a diversity of cultures, too. Third, we would want to structure things such that, globally, cultural evolution guides us towards morally better views and societies. I've already described a number of mechanisms by which some cultures or specific cultural traits can win out over time. Some of these mechanisms are probably not correlated with what's morally best. That one society has greater fertility than another, or exhibits faster economic growth, does not imply that that society is morally superior. In contrast, the most important mechanisms for improving our moral views are reason, reflection, and empathy, and the persuasion of others based on those mechanisms. If two groups engage in good faith debate, and one is convinced to change their mind via the force of reason or empathy, then, in general, that group is more likely to have gotten to an improved point of view. Certain forms of free speech would therefore be crucial to enable better ideas to spread. Spaces for good faith debate and careful argument and deliberation, especially, should be actively encouraged. But this is an instrumental justification of free speech, and it might not apply to all forms of speech. It seems that techniques for duping people, lying, bullshitting, and brainwashing, should be discouraged, and should be especially off-limits for people in positions of power, such as those in political office. Otherwise, the world could end up converging on the ideas that are most alluring rather than those that are best justified. Fairly free migration would also be helpful. If people emigrate from one society to another, that gives us at least some evidence that that latter society is better for those who migrated there. Of the world's adults, 15% would like to move to another country if they had the opportunity. Demand is especially high in low-income countries, and among people who would like to move, the majority would like to move to a handful of rich liberal democracies. Plausibly, this is because living in the rich liberal democracies would provide a higher quality of life. Fairly free migration would help people to vote with their feet, and the societies that are more attractive to live in would be rewarded with greater net immigration and grow more powerful over time. At the same time, we would want to prevent any one culture from becoming so powerful that it could conquer all other cultures through economic or military domination. Potentially, this could require international norms or laws preventing any single country from becoming too populous, just as antitrust regulations prevent any single company from dominating a market and exerting monopoly power. This last point, that we need to structure global society so that cultural evolution guides the world towards better values and better societal structures, highlights an issue facing the design of a morally explorative world that I'll call the lock-in paradox. We need to lock in some institutions and ideas in order to prevent a more thoroughgoing lock-in of values. One challenge is that these institutions and ideas will be morally controversial. For example, from many fundamentalist religious perspectives, the idea that we would encourage or even allow a diversity of worldviews might be regarded as abominable. Similarly, the idea that the path to the correct moral view is via reflection and good faith debate, rather than studying the scripture of a holy book, is not one that everyone would accept. The lock-in paradox thus resembles the familiar paradox of tolerance, the necessity for liberal societies to defend themselves against intolerant views that would undermine their freedom, even if doing so requires curtailing the very tolerance they want to preserve. I think we must live with these paradoxes. If we wish to avoid the lock-in of bad moral views, an entirely laissez-faire approach would not be possible. Over time, the forces of cultural evolution would dictate how the future goes, and the ideologies that lead to the greatest military power and that try to eliminate their competition would suppress all others. In this chapter, I've suggested that we are living through a period of plasticity, that the moral views that shape society are like molten glass that can be blown into many different shapes. But the glass is cooling, and at some point, perhaps in the not-too-distant future, it might set. Whether it sets into a sculpture that is beautiful and crystalline, or mangled and misshapen, is in significant part up to us. Or perhaps, when the glass sets, we get no shape at all. Perhaps instead it cracks and shatters. Perhaps in the not-too-distant future, history ends in a more literal sense than we've discussed in this chapter. Not with the victory of a single ideology, but with the permanent collapse of civilization. It's this possibility that I'll turn to next.